Our next case is U.S. Aero Team, Incorporated versus United States, 2021-2272. Mr. Johns.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, I represent United States Aero Team. We've asked the Court to reverse the decision of the trial court at the Court of Federal Claims, related to the trial on the appeal of U.S. Aero Team's request for an equitable adjustment.
Can I just ask you a housekeeping threshold question, which is, I understand from the briefing there's a companion case at the ASBCA, and I was just interested in involving the same contract dispute.
Yes,
so what theories are presented there?
So in that case, when the original REA was submitted, it was submitted with 10 factors. And so the government and U.S. Aero Team dealt with the costs and the issues in those 10 separate areas. This case only dealt with what was referred to as Factor 1, which was the manufacturing and assembly of the running gear. The ASBCA case deals with those remaining issues that were not related to the running gear.
Is that kind of unusual to split it up? I don't recall seeing a split in a case between the two bodies.
It's non-traditional, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So as a preliminary matter, I think just to put our discussion this morning in the context that the trial court's ruling on entitlement occurred almost immediately upon completion of a nearly five-day trial with witness testimony, introduction of documentary evidence, and argument of counsel. The transcript is in the appendix. It begins at 2058 because there's no written opinion.
Well, yeah, the transcript. It seems there are three issues: constructive change, cardinal change, and commercial impracticability. And the trial court pointed out that you didn't meet any of the requirements for any of them. The requirements of the contract were not changed. You simply decided to do the work yourself, and that cost more money, but this was a fixed price contract.
Certainly that's the court's finding, and that's why we're here today, because we respectfully disagree with that finding. And in those three areas, we believe that the court committed reversible legal error in the court's analysis of those issues. And, Your Honor, the first issue being constructive change, perhaps what we spent most of the time discussing at trial, the court actually, in the ruling, added an element or a requirement that just isn't present in any of the cases that this court has issued, the most two recently in 2020 being the Kiewit case and the BGT Holdings case. The requirements across the board are that there is additional work that is performed on a contract and that it is ordered either explicitly or impliedly by the government. The Kiewit case takes it a little bit further and says that this can be a formal or informal.
Okay, well, I mean, we can quibble with some of the comments that the district court, that the Court of Federal Claims may have met, and the government deals with explaining some of that. But where does, I guess, let's look at the facts of this case, and where does that get you? How do you get a constructive change? You went to the government, and what they said is, okay, you're going to take the work that was done by the subcontractor and you're going to bring it in-house. How does that give you a constructive change where they're ordering you implicitly or explicitly to do this?
Well, it
in a way that obligates them for the additional cost.
Well, it does that because the government did issue that change, the May 15th, 2012, email from the contracting officer to U.S. Aero Team and members of
the government team. Is if it had not authorized the change, you would have been paying the subcontractor $38,000, and presumably you took it in-house to get something cheaper than that.
Well,
so I guess it was something that you were suggesting that you wanted to do, and it wasn't something that they were required to do or was necessitated by the circumstances that you changed the way it was being done. It was mainly a thing you did, just try to save yourself some money.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the facts of the case actually support the finding that it was simply a matter of cost. PDI, the subcontractor, who is a directed source in the contract, had effectively committed an anticipatory repudiation of the contract. They told U.S. Aero Team they were not going to manufacture.
I thought that at least the government says, with some support in the claims court discussion, that you did not prove that PDI would not supply you this at the newly raised PDI price.
Well, certainly that's one of the issues that we did raise in our brief, is that we think that the trial court, in particular with that factual finding, was incorrect. There was a statement during testimony from one of the principals at PDI that for a higher price, they might have provided it. But we also know from the evidence that they had not provided any units for months and months and had entered into a termination agreement with U.S. Aero Team because they were no longer going to produce it. So,
what was added to the requirements of the contract?
So, U.S. Aero Team was never required to manufacture that running gear assembly. It was a directed purchase. And so that was a rather administrative limited task where they would issue a purchase order, the vendor would supply it, and then it would be incorporated. But in the absence of any vendor, and there was no evidence that there was any other vendor available besides PDI, in the absence of any other vendor, U.S. Aero Team went to the government and proposed this solution. Rather than terminate the contract, rather than stop delivery, because again, this was a priority rated contract.
I don't hear you arguing the requirements of the law, constructive change or cardinal change.
Well, the constructive change was that U.S. Aero Team was never required to manufacture. After the direction of the PCO on May 12th, they were on the hook.
You volunteered and the government agreed, right?
And the government agreed. They included that as a requirement in the contract. And
there's, it wasn't driven by the government or some necessity, or at least those were the findings of the district court, which I think would be pretty hard to dislodge at this juncture.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there is anything in the jurisprudence that says that it must be driven or it must be the government's idea. In fact, it can be the government's mistake. It can be an informal direction. But clearly, once the May 12th order
So you come to the government and you say, hey, we think it'd be better and more convenient for us to get rid of the subcontractor and just do it in-house. And the government says, sure, do that. Then they're liable for any additional costs you expend beyond a fixed price contract?
Now, I think that the evidence, Your Honor, was that the government and U.S. Aero Team knew that that vendor was not going to be available and there were no other vendors. The government's option was to either approve U.S. Aero Team or terminate the contract.
Why would approve meet the standard for government direction under either constructive or cardinal change?
Well, once the government made that change, that became a requirement that U.S. Aero Team had to meet. They at that point didn't have the option not to perform, and so again, there is no jurisprudence that says the idea has to originate with the government, and it wasn't for the convenience.
The change you're saying was that the government at some point came to say in the email, I think you rely on?
The May 12th email Appendix
said,
2000.
Now our contract requires you to make this thing in-house.
It doesn't use those exact express words, but it has the effect.
Isn't that what would be required for the either cardinal or constructive change theory of government directing you, as opposed to saying allowing?
I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. When you look at particularly BGT and the Keywad cases, that it can be an informal order of the government. It can be implied. And so I don't think the genesis of the idea to solve the problem is dispositive of whether that requirement is met.
You're into your rebuttal time. You can continue or save it.
I'll save my time, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Hellman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This Court should affirm the judgment of the Court of Federal Claims, which, after a five-day trial, found that U.S. Aerotune failed to prove all three of its claims, constructive change, cardinal change, and commercial impracticability. Importantly, the Court of Federal Claims here made two key factual findings. The first is that the subassemblies at issue that were initially produced by PDI continued to be available. It's just that the price increased. That's a factual finding. This Court reviews it for clear error.
So that was your friend's main argument, or one of the principal arguments, that the vendor was no longer available to do this. So this was a necessity for completion of the contract, and you contend, or the Court of Federal Claims made contrary findings.
That's correct, Judge Prost. That was an argument that plaintiff appellant put forth at trial. There was testimony from a PDI employee, a third party, who was actually present at this meeting, the key meeting on March 8th, 2012, saying we were willing to make the part, we wanted to charge more money for it. And that's what the Court of Federal Claims
said. Where's the finding to that effect?
There's two in the court's decision, which was rendered from the bench. The first is at Appendix 5. It's page... trial transcript, page 838, lines 14 through 16, it says, the evidence does not support that at the higher price, PDI would not have continued to supply the product. And that at Appendix 7 on page 845, it says, it actually continues from the previous page at line 25, it says, the issue arose, it sounds like, from the testimony that after they raised their prices in PDI's PDI raised their prices for the second contract and raised their prices at all for production, further production. It wasn't that they couldn't have, it's that they wouldn't once they didn't get the price they wanted. And then the next paragraph it says it was also a matter of choice on the part of the plaintiff not to pay the higher price.
Okay.
So there's testimony the trial court found that PDI continued to be available but just higher price. And this goes to your point, Judge Prost, that, you know, U.S. Aerotune is seeking to get compensation because it made the decision to make the part itself when it could have continued procuring it under a higher price, and it wouldn't be eligible to receive a price adjustment if it simply paid a higher price for PDI.
It would be a different case, would it not, if the subcontractor goes out of business or refuses to deal with him, and he comes to the government and he says, we can't do this work because the subcontractor is not cooperating or whatever, and so we have to do it in-house, and it's going to cost us more to do it in-house, and then the government's nod, wink, or whatever for that would be compensable, arguably.
It would certainly be a different case, that's true. And I think, as Mr. Johns mentioned, in that case, the government would have options. It could say, we don't want to pay the higher price, so we want to terminate the contract. We have enough of these trailers. We don't need them at a higher price, or we want to go out and re-procure. The contract provided that additional suppliers could come on board and become authorized. In fact, U.S. Aerotune was one of those suppliers when it made the decision to take the production in-house. It received authorization eventually from the government to become an authorized supplier. It could then provide the running gear to other trailer manufacturers in subsequent contracts. So it was a business decision that it had made, thinking that it could make the parts more efficiently, less expensively, and had it been able to do so, it would have kept the additional profits. And that's the sort of the whole nature of the firm fixed price contracts here. It incentivizes the contractor to lower its costs.
Yeah, but it's a fair criticism of the Court of Federal Claims, is it not, that she seemed to have placed a lot of weight on the fact that this was a firm fixed price contract, which you seem to be doing here, whereas in your brief, I think you made clear that you do not read what she said as saying that's black letter law and no deviation would ever have been required. I mean, that would undo all of the principles like constructive change and cardinal change, et cetera, we're talking about.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the distinction is this. Firm fixed price contracts preclude this sort of adjustment when a part supplier increases its prices, you know, supply chain issues or whatnot, and the contractor is not allowed to come to the government and say, my prices went up, provide me additional compensation. The contractor, in a firm fixed price contract, and there are other contracting vehicles that the contractor can use if it's worried about it, but the contractor is responsible for managing the prices. That's why U.S. Aerotune got a purchase order with PDI for that price amount. It could have enforced that purchase order. Now, it's a different case, as you said, if there's no authorized suppliers and U.S. Aerotune can't perform, that gets into commercial impossibility, and that excuses a breach. So U.S. Aerotune could have come to the government and said, we can't continue performing. The one supplier that we were authorized to use is no longer available. You know, we're in breach, but it's not our fault.
Can I just ask you about just done on the ground, real life? You know, the Court of Federal Claims expressed some sympathy for the other side. And certainly, while the initial contract was ongoing, this was when this price got up. So they had to eat it. But by the time they did the current contract, they knew what the higher prices were, but they didn't change the bid, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, and I just want to make sure I clarify the nuance. The first contract, yes, they had a purchase order with PDI, then PDI was trying to raise its prices. During this time period, and this was in sort of May and June of 2012, U.S. Aerotune already knew that PDI didn't want to perform for the lower price, wanted to raise its price. Yet U.S. Aerotune bid on the follow-on contract, as we called it at the trial court, the 39 contract. It actually lowered its ultimate price by $20,000. So rather than factoring in, you know, it's going to cost us additional money to build this, or we don't actually know how much it's going to cost, but certainly if we were to keep buying it from PDI, it's going to cost us $38,000 versus $20,000. U.S. Aerotune actually lowered its own ultimate trailer price for this follow-on, substantially larger contract. And this just goes to the point, this was a business decision. U.S. Aerotune thought it could make the running gear itself better and cheaper. It was, you know, it was incorporating this large component into a trailer. It had similar capabilities, it thought, that PDI did. There's another component that came up at trial where it was a hydraulic cylinder that also became unavailable. And U.S. Aerotune didn't offer to take that one in-house because it didn't have those capabilities. Here, it thought it could do a better, cheaper job.
Did they ultimately perform the contract?
They ultimately performed the contract. They ultimately built the running gear for the trailers and ended up costing them, they alleged, about $60,000 per running gear, so more than the PDI price even. But they ultimately performed it, and that goes to the point that it wasn't impossible. There's no impossibility here. This is the Raytheon case, which we cited, talks about when the contractors actually performed, there is the commercial impossibility or commercial impracticability argument is very hard to prevail on because the evidence shows that it's possible to perform it.
Well, they've tripled the cost by now. So, I mean, doesn't impossibility include some astronomical price? I mean, you know, at some level, anything is possible commercially as long as you want to pay exorbitant price. Doesn't the fact that this costs $60,000 sort of get closer to it's impossible as a practical matter?
Well, I think it doesn't with $60,000, Your Honor. I think astronomical is not $60,000. Well, in a trailer that costs $200,000, where they were already paying $20,000 for the part that was 50% of the trailer, suggesting it may have been underpriced, an increase of $20,000 or $40,000 for
tripling
that.
Tripling
the cost of the subcomponent. But the cases that talk about commercial impossibility, and again, the Raytheon case, you look at the entire cost of the contract. So you can't just look at the cost of the price. If they were purchasing a tire that went from $20 to $120, you could say that, you know, quadrupled or quintupled the price. But in the scheme of the overall trailer, that's $200,000. That's not astronomical. That's not such a commercial impracticability that it becomes, I think the language is commercially senseless to perform. Here, surely they didn't calculate this properly. They lost profit, but profitability and their profit margins is not the guiding factor. It's whether it's, and it's actually
the... Is this contract expired now? It's been performed? Is this, are we into a follow-on contract?
Both contracts have been performed. I believe certainly the first contract has been performed, John. The follow-on contract, there's some dispute that's pending at the board that you discussed about, there are some issues with delivery of the trailers and some other issues. I am not entirely sure whether all the trailers have been delivered. The follow-on contract allowed for about 80 trailers or so, but the government didn't have to purchase all 80. It was sort of staggered. The government could order.
Is this a 2012 contract? And it might not have been completed yet, really?
I'm not sure that the final deliveries have been
done.
Yes, but yes, Your Honor, the follow-on contract was taken a while. Well, the approval, it took them extra time to get the running gear authorized by the government. I just want to make one final point on the issue of cardinal change that you discussed with Mr. Johns and whether the work goes beyond the scope. That, again, is a factual inquiry. This court in Rumsfeld said that that's principally a factual inquiry. Appellant cited Rumsfeld in its reply. We didn't have an opportunity to respond. But the court, again, at Appendix 7, said that this was the same product. It was the same specifications. It cost more, but it doesn't constitute a cardinal change because the scope of the contract didn't change. If this court has no further questions, we respectfully request that the judgment below be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Johns has about 3.5 minutes of rebuttal time. I guess it's 4.5 minutes.
Thank you again. A few issues, and we did in our brief, we did challenge this finding of the trial court that PDI was available to make these trailers, but simply at a higher price. And the origin of the higher price came from testimony and not from any actual purchase order. And in fact, we have a quote. We had a quote from PDI on the 27th of February 2012, and that was provided to support the second contract. Now, there was some discussion about the second contract. The second contract still had PDI as a required vendor in the tech data package. It was still a source-controlled vendor. The government knew that as of March 8th, that PDI was no longer going to produce. And so U.S. Aero Team had to quote to PDI because they were the required source in the tech data package in the RFP for the contract. And again, the timing there, their proposal was submitted on the 7th of May. The direction to build in-house doesn't occur until May 12th. So I think that those are significant. And in fact, the court even in looking at the issue of impracticability, and this is page 845 of the trial transcript, the court talks about the increase in price. And the court said, did that make them an unavailable source? I guess. But it was also a matter of choice on the part of the plaintiff not to pay the higher price. So certainly the trial court also is saying here that, yeah, perhaps, you know,
they are unavailable. If we believe that the evidence truly showed that they could have produced those trailers at that price, and I think that the evidence just doesn't show that. On the Rumsfeld case, we've cited that. The Rumsfeld case explicitly rejects the notion that only if that explicitly rejects the notion that you can't have a cardinal change if it's the same end product. Rumsfeld, as Mr. Hellman says, it talks about the case-by-case factual inquiry, but it specifically rejects the notion that if you have the same product, the same end product, you can't have a cardinal change.
Didn't Rumsfeld deny equitable adjustment?
They did in that case, Your Honor. It was related to packing MREs, is my recollection. So the end result was not favorable to the plaintiff, but the question of law is applicable to us here, that that it's not enough to say, well, you were making TT90 trailers before, you're still making a TT90 trailer, you can't have a cardinal change in the contract. The change from purchasing the running gear to manufacturing it in-house was a significant change. And as the trial court pointed out, the contracting officer invited U.S. Aero Team to submit an REA, and they did. And the REA was eventually rejected by a subsequent contracting officer. But the constructive change analysis was never performed by that contracting officer. The trial court isn't bound by that contracting officer, but it is illustrative of the history of the process. Certainly, Mr. Abney expected that there would be a submission request for costs. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under submission. That concludes our arguments for today.